This is a podcast about tough mudders, Spartan, and obstacle course races. It's about getting muddy, being physical, being inspiring, and being inspired. Some of the toughest courses on the planet. You want camaraderie? You want to walk away with a massive sense of achievement, of facing up to a challenge? Get some. Mudtap.com. Ladies and gentlemen, here's your host, Lance.
Welcome to the Mudtap Obstacle Course Racing Podcast. I found out about Fandon's courtesy of Richard Pringle. In a moment of madness, I signed up with about 2 months to prepare for the brutal SAS load-bearing event. This was not my first load-bearing event, as I did the Para 10 tab, which gave me a taste of what I could expect. I never expected to find another event which fascinates me as much as Fandon's does. A lot of this is because I can test myself on my own terms, and for obvious reasons, it's got the strong SAS Special Forces history. I was fortunate enough to get Ken Jones on the interview, and I would strongly advise anyone to read his book Darkness Descending. It is an awesome testament to human capability and endurance. To all taking on the challenge, you will not regret the pain and the demand that you put on yourself. To sign up for the Fan Dance or any of the Test March series, go to http://thefandanceRace.com. That is thefandanceRace.com. Follow Mudtap on Facebook and Twitter and grab the interviews on iTunes for iPod, iPhones and iPads, or for Android, use the Stitcher app. Ken, thanks a lot for taking time to speak with me. I know you've still been recovering a bit from a recent operation. I'm very happy to be able to speak with you again. I know you're a very busy man with a lot of the events that you've been putting on. So I'm very glad, number one, to speak to you, and number two, to learn a bit more about Fandons.
Okay, you're welcome, Lance. It's always good to speak to you, mate.
I've actually read your book, which we'll come back to in a second. What I'd like to do is just find out a bit more about you, and just so that people that actually listen to the podcast can actually find out a bit about your history and where you come from. So can you give us an idea of how you actually got into the Army and the SAS, and then we can discuss a couple of things out of the book?
Ever since I was a child, I always harbored ambitions to join the military. I grew up near an Army camp in Nestcliffe in Shropshire. And as a young boy, my brother and some of our more unruly friends from the village would dress in camouflage fatigues, and we'd sneak around or trespass in the military camp, and we'd basically just cause a bit of trouble and do what we thought was playing army and just wreak a bit of havoc and destruction on the local camp and try and not get apprehended by the by whatever military unit was carrying out training exercises at the time. And it kind of stemmed from there, really.
Once you went into the Army, you actually went into the para regiment first, and then you migrated into the SAS. Was it a natural progression to go into para first, or how did you actually end up in para? What was the motivation to go to the para regiment?
Well, aside of my childhood ambitions, I kind of discarded a military career, and I actually wanted to go to university, and I was interested in football and and rock and roll concerts. And it's really following disastrous A-level results that left me with no real chance. When I say disastrous, there were no results. I completely failed everything. So I don't think I was ready for education at the time. It just came at the wrong part of my life, and I was just forced back into pursuing a military career. I'd grown up in the middle of a countryside where there was no work opportunities, and a lot of my friends and people I knew, they'd never really left the county or done anything that I considered inspiring. I mean, the idea of an exciting weekend was a game of Saturday League football and then to go out drinking and fighting each night. So, you know, I thought there's got to be more to life than, you know, young farmers club meetings, Sunday League, Saturday and Sunday League football, getting into mindless scraps. Or, and I certainly didn't want to go on a YTS apprenticeship at the time, so I thought, I'll join the army. And at that time, I remember the BBC and Channel 4 run some cracking documentaries. There was one on the Royal Marines Commandos, and I think it was a documentary series highlighting the demands of going through the 6-7 months of commando training at RM Limpston. And at the same time, there was a documentary on the paras, two documentaries on paras, were one by Channel 4 on the all-arms commando test, and another one by the BBC, which followed the similar format of a Royal Marine documentary. And it became quite clear that the Royal Marines and the paras were the standout elite units in the UK, and arguably the world. So I applied for both at the same time. Just so happens that the paras offered me an earlier start date, so I signed on the dotted line and commenced training as soon as I was able to.
And overall, the para training, I know from speaking with various other people, is quite harsh. How did you cope with the initial training demand?
Para-reg training for me was harder than special forces selection. I mean, everything's relative. I undertook selection with 4 years military experience as a paratrooper, but to make that jump from naive country boy who had these misguided thoughts that he was pretty hard and fit, it was the biggest shock of a lifetime. I mean, I'd never cooked my own meal. I'd never ironed any of my own clothes. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't even know how to shave properly. And to turn up at the factory, the Power-Edge depot, it's a pretty fearsome place. The training was utterly brutal. And some of the thrashings that were inflicted upon us were just, I mean, you know, I'm not even sure if they could happen this day and age. If some of the instructors be tried for crimes against humanity or something like that. They were absolutely shocking. I remember really tough guys being in tears, and I reached breaking point, or my own perceived breaking point, so many times. I lost sight of what a breaking point was, or just stopped even caring. It was in great part mindless. It was brutal. I wasn't the most naturally accomplished soldier, so I didn't even learn a lot. But that was mainly because I, like so many others, were focused on survival because we're thrashed so badly. And, you know, to say you've been through the para depot, it's one thing to wear a maroon beret, as anyone who's done all arms company has done. But to have been through the para depot, that's something else altogether. It is on another level. It is off the scale of brutality within perspective of the British military system. It doesn't really get much harder than that. It was a horrific shock to me.
Based on what you said, there's not much that you could do in preparation wise to actually deal with that.
I mean, there's not much you can do to prepare for that. I mean, some other guys were a couple of years older than myself, were a bit better prepared. They genuinely were hard, whereas I thought I was hard, and I wasn't. And they were fit. There was good marathon runners. I mean, I thought I was pretty tasty because I was running 7 miles 5 times a week. I could do 13 pull-ups, and you know, that was about it. But as soon as I got there, there was a new pecking order was established, and you know, some of the guys were hard, tough lads, supremely fit, and you know, I was way down the bottom. I was struggling for survival all the way through.
And then from there, obviously, you spent 4 years in the para regiment and served in various places. Now, the step from going from the para regiment into the SAS, what brought about that motivation and that decision?
I mean, ultimately, I think it was a succession of two back-to-back tours in Northern Ireland, and I'd got pretty pissed off with it. It's no way of life. This was pre-Afghanistan and Iraq. There wasn't anything going on, and everyone I've ever spoke to has always maintained that the most violent time to be in the army is when there's nothing going on, there's no conflict, there's no operational duties to occupy you with, you know, with some of the senior staff treated you like absolute dogs, and a lot of men wanted to leave and got disillusioned. And I just thought there's got to be more to soldiering, and indeed more to life of this. I began to, you know, I couldn't see myself in the military system with a parachute regiment any longer. In some part, that may have been my own fault, but, you know, I just, how I saw myself and my colleagues around me began to shift dramatically. And there was a few extremely violent episodes and incidents that, you know, that propagated my decision to consider leaving the army altogether, or giving selection a crack, which I eventually did.
And were you a lot better going into selection due to the experience that you had with it, with the paras? Were you able to cope with it a lot better than what you expected?
Well, with selection, I mean, selection's a personality thing in so many respects. Whereas in the paras, you'll be hounded and beasted and thrashed, and you'll never be allowed to give in. Whereas on selection, nobody's shouting at you. They leave you alone. You can go through the 4-week Hills course. DS aren't really interested in you, but you just march, you're on your own. Sometimes you won't see anyone else apart from a DS at RV points on the entire march. And I mean, my personality was fit with that. I was comfortable. I was happy to be left alone and, you know, marched. I could, my level of exertion was matched by my own ambition and will to succeed. And no one else set in the pace, whereas there'd been a PTI or a force crew doing St. Power Edge. I was comfortable with that, and I was very well trained. And, you know, I was quite lucky that my method into the regiment was quite unorthodox. It was as a civilian, and prior to going on the course, I had a 5-month pre-selection course specifically for civilians with former military experience or current serving reservists who wanted to have a go at regular selection. So it was an odd way in for some, maybe a back door. But I left, become a civilian. I considered applying for 2-3 SAS at the time, but as it happened, 3 days before I left, I got speaking to an ex-2-rep Foreign Legion guy who was on the verge of going for selection himself, and indeed he passed. But he told me not to go for 2-3, and he gave me a scrap bit of paper with a telephone number, and it said R Squadron on it. I didn't even know what it was. He just said, give him a call. So I give him a call, and they said, right, come and see us at Stirling Lines as soon as you're out. And I did just that.
Obviously, you spent a certain amount of time within the SAS, and I'd like to get into the decision that you made to go to Romania to do this climb, and actually where you got injured in the avalanche. What was a part of that, and how did that come about?
My military career was pretty short-lived. The main contributory factor to that is obviously the accident, which effectively put an end to my military career. I mean, you could say I got badged and didn't do a lot, if anything, after that at all. But when I had my first interview at Stirling Lines, the first thing the OC said to me, he told me that even with my para background, it was far from guaranteed that I'd get action. So he did say at the time I should consider going to university. He said he told me a lot of blokes in the regiment actually regretted never having educated themselves, and even in spite of a lucrative security industry, said so many guys with an incredible amount of experience leave and they end up working as labourers on building sites and fixing roofs and fitting scaffolding. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's a noble trade to be in. And But he just advised me to get myself educated. And he said, by the time I graduated, I'd have only been 26 anyway. So he told me to come back. Anyway, I ignored what he said and I went for selection anyway. But fortunately, I was on a reserve engagement. So I could come as I go as I pleased. And after I got badge, I did decide to go to university. You know, I took a year and a half out and a way to, you know, to fill the gap, you know, of, you know, excitement and adrenaline and adventure from the military, I decided to go to Romania. It was a place that always fascinated me. It was, as far as I was concerned, it's one of Europe's last great wildernesses. I mean, it's just a land not so far from us, still full of bears and wolves and lynx and, you know, some of the, possibly, but I think it's the largest fragmented forest in all of Europe. And, you know, it just appealed to me greatly. And I love to climb. And you know, I just set the ambition of, during my Christmas holiday from university, that I'd send myself off on an adventure. And Romania seemed like a pretty wild and exciting place to go. And as it happened, I was scheduled to rejoin Special Forces down at Poole, literally a week after I was due to come back from Romania. So it was quite hard. I was very so close to rejoining the system again and going back to my old troop. And, you know, incidents in Romania, you know, my fate took a turn for the worst, or, you know, who knows. And obviously disaster struck and my military career came to an end then.
Mm. Reading through the book, there's something which was, to me, very interesting, and I'd like to find out a bit more about you. You mentioned that during your military training, your trainers were actually instructing you to pay attention to your gut feeling and your awareness and any signs that feel something feels out of the ordinary or doesn't feel right. I did see in the first part of the book that you mentioned that you had this sudden fear or feeling of disaster was going to happen, and again there were two ravens which landed close to you at the time. Now, can you expand a bit more on this intuition part of it, and you know what your perception was and how you felt about that?
Well, I'd never really thought about it before. If you'd have asked me so many years ago, I'd have said stuff like that was utter nonsense. And I'm not going to claim I've got some special intuition or, you know, ability to foresee anything, because I don't. But I remember on selection, our chief instructor, a Scottish guy called Robbie, in the jungle, he just said, "Look, lads," he goes, "if you're on patrol and you get a feeling, a gut instinct, or sensation that something's not right, don't crack on and ignore it." He says, "Call a halt and let the patrol commander know about it." He goes, "Maybe nothing will be done about it, but if you really feel it, you know, who knows, then we might divert the course or go and do something else, or, you know, it just advise us never to ignore it." And I mean, this was a highly experienced, hard guy, and to hear him say something like that, and I thought, it was little comments like that, it was reasons like that that, you know, I think really made me go for selection in the first place. It was a different kind of soldiering. I mean, there was no rules or SOPs or military regulations governing any sort of conduct like that. And I thought, this is such a pure instinctive form of soldiering and stuff. It doesn't submit to rules and regulations. And I think what a wonderful thing he's just said, even if it is nonsense, and I don't believe it is nonsense. I fully believe it. I mean, the skill is to, because I think as human beings, we've all got this instinct and power within us. But, you know, as we've become softened with modern technology and all our creature comforts, I think we've become blunted and we lose our instinct. Not to feel these sensations, but when they do happen, the real skill is to act upon it and pay attention to it. And as you know from my book, my story, rather, when I had that feeling of foreboding, I kind of identified, but was having that belief in myself and the feeling. And as you know, I did nothing about it. I did the opposite to what Robbie said. I just cracked on anyway. But of course, I got no patrol commander with me to tell. And like I said in the book, I wasn't gonna call off the mountain ascent just because of some odd feeling I couldn't explain or didn't understand. It's very odd. I mean, it probably doesn't mean much to anyone at all, and you know, might think it's just madness or just some oddball character trait or something. But so be it. It's just one of those things I was taught in the army, and I've try to pay attention to it ever since, and just I do try and be aware and maintain some sort of vigilance on any gut feelings or instinct I have. And I guess the one parallel I can draw that everyone can relate to is, you know, you someone's staring at you, and for some inexplicable reason, you turn round and look at them and you catch them staring you. It's almost as if some part of you can feel that you've got eyes on you and you turn round. I mean, I think that's happened to everyone. And so, I mean, that's the easiest example I can cite that, you know, gives the theory some credibility that we have got this in us. It might be an hunting instinct to make sure we're not being preyed upon or about to be ambushed by an animal or someone or you know, it's very interesting stuff.
There's a lot of recorded incidents where people have been in situations or anything of that nature, and that they've said something. I knew something was going to happen, or I knew this was going to happen. It's a very instinctive, as you say, gut feeling. It's almost like an emotional response to something. It's very subtle, but it's very sure when people have mentioned it. It's not like that I thought this or I thought that. It's always been, you know, I knew something was not right, or I knew this was right, or I knew this was, I felt about this. And it's, I just find it interesting that it's something like that is highlighted by somebody who's a very, very experienced soldier and actually imparts this knowledge to new people, which I think is phenomenally interesting.
I mean, it's not something for the soldier. I think it's all in us, and we should all, you know, just be aware of ourselves and the abilities of our own minds and what we're capable of. But like I said, we are losing not only sight of this, but just our capabilities as well. We are becoming blunted, and even current serving soldiers at Hereford and Poole, you know, soldiering's changing and stuff. They, you know, as a race, as human beings, we may lose some of these skills, but it's very interesting. It's kind of fascinating to know that we've got these capabilities within us, as with most things, because it can't be proved or rationalized through scientific testing, or, you know, can't be recorded in some sort of data on a laboratory. It can just be perceived as nonsense. But that's what
I think. It's something at some point where it will be able to be recorded, because there's a lot of research going on in quantum physics and various other things, and there's a lot of interesting information that's coming out of almost quantum science and quantum physics, and it's actually starting to support some of the theories which people have had about various other aspects within science. So at the moment, just because we don't have any kind of recorded proof of it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just that we don't have a way of proving that factorially through science or any kind of methodology that we know of at the moment. So I'm fairly sure there's something interesting that's going to develop out of that.
It would be arrogance and ignorance to think just because we don't understand or can't explain anything, it doesn't exist.
Coming back to the book, I was actually, whenever I was reading through the book, thing that struck me out of the whole situation was that you were in a very, very challenging situation, obviously, with the injury and being in the middle of nowhere and having to get to your destination, which is to safety, and also to get some medical treatment. Certain parts of it, you were struggling with, you know, the cold, and also being able to cope with, you know, resting enough plus moving and getting to your destination. But you also had to suffer through doing multiple river crossings, as well as crawling through snow, and actually also walking with an injured hip. The mental discipline and the capability to just carry on with that, is that something that you expected to be able to cope with, or is it just that you focused on the job at hand at any given time?
Well, you know, I can't claim that I've got some sort of mental resilience upon suffering those injuries, I thought, okay, I'm going to tough this out and crawl for 3 days or whatever. I mean, I don't know what would have happened if I'd have known that. I may have just jacked it in then. I was just dealing with a problem at hand and was constantly in the hope that each day would be the last. And I had no idea I'd be going for so long, and I'd have been bloody demoralised if I had have done. It was just the mental resilience bit. I was just dealing with it piecemeal as it come to me, and I was on my limits, and I was just doing my best to make the ordeal come to an end as quick as possible. And I certainly, didn't have it in mind I'd be going for so long. And it was, I just did what I could at the time. And, well, to be honest, and you can talk about my mental resilience, the most profound learning experience of it was to learn in so many regards what a coward you are and how weak you are. Whereas before I thought of myself as a tough fighting man, the realities of it all, when the shit hits the fan like that, you're not quite as hard as you think you are or you fancy yourself to be.
Mm. Yeah, and that's, I think it's a very true statement. And on the flip side of that, you don't realize how strong and capable and adaptable you are until you're actually in a situation like that where you have to be creative and insistent and persistent and also just carry on with doing what you need to do to survive. So it's very much of a double-edged sword in that regard.
Well, the body's an incredible, capable machine. It will do what it has to stay alive. It was just a matter of, as of most things, it was a mental battle. As long as you issue your body the order and command to keep moving, it will crack on. The body doesn't have little tantrums and get upset or feel sorry for it. You tell it to move, and it doesn't matter if it's got broken bones or frostbitten limbs. It will just, if it needs to, it will draw the blood into the core to keep the vital organs alive, and it doesn't care if you lose an arm or a leg or toes or fingers. Like I say, it was just a mental battle to tell myself to keep moving.
Mm. One amusing little thing I want to pick out is the old guy in the hut in the end. Did he ever get the new boots that you wanted to send him?
He didn't get the new boots. Between one thing and another, I got caught up. I was in hospital for God knows how long, 3 or 4 months after the operation. I did make some arrangements to get some boots to him, and apparently I heard a few mixed stories. Some people have told me he got them. I won't be surprised if they were nicked by some middleman. I've kind of lost sight of what happened to him. And funnily enough, I met a girl just a couple of days before my accident. I met a girl on the train in Romania. She was helping me. Apparently, I was on the wrong train at the time, so she helped me out a bit. And I'm still in touch with her to this day. And she's a doctor now working in the UK, but she's in the process of helping me track down a few key people who helped in the old man's hut. So it'll be interesting to see what's happened to them all and whether he did get the boots or not.
Excellent. The other thing is you've recovered reasonably well from the injury that you sustained, and you also then got back into cycling and rode back to fitness and everything else. And is this something that you were surprised with, the body's ability to recover from something as serious as that and just carry on functioning and still do what you more or less expected or that you targeted out of it?
Well, for the best part, I didn't really appreciate the extent of my injuries. I was pretty angry and resented them, and I was stubbornly focused on recovery. I mean, for a great part of it, my life was in someone else's hands, especially with my stomach, and I needed life-saving surgery twice due to internal bleeding. So, I was... I didn't do much to contribute to my own survival of that, to be honest. But, the leg injuries, I didn't really know what to expect. I got hope, and you can do a lot with hope. You have some of that. I'd somehow, in spite of all the uncertainty and insecurity, I'd got it in mind that I would recover and I'd reach a very high level of fitness again. And I did manage to achieve that. It took a bit longer than I imagined. I think it was 3 or 4 years before I was, cutting about again. But I wouldn't say I surprised myself, but I expected that of myself, and it was nice to be fit again and have a kind of a return to a life I once knew of being active again. And I got hope. You can do a lot with that, and I was motivated, and I stay positive. A good, strong, positive outlook, and you can do so much with that.
And as part of your return to fitness, you actually did the same route which a lot of the people do in the fan dance event at the moment. And this was one of your goals, was it not?
One of my first major tests, as soon as I come off my crutches. My mind was pretty weak. I've been off crutches, on crutches 2 years, and then within, I think it was 5 or 6 days, some friends from my squadron had a little celebration for me, picked me up, drove me to Breck, and they said, right, we're gonna go and do the fan dance. And of course, that was retracing a piece of my own personal history, and well, all of our own histories. And so we walked the fan dance route. I carried absolutely nothing. I was still pretty weak and thin, and my muscles had atrophied considerably. But I managed to make it up, carrying nothing more than a packed lunch and a waterproof jacket and a flask of Opti. And at the top of Jacob's Ladder, I was presented with a little wing dagger badge. And it was a nice little intimate ceremony with close friends. And it was kind of there that the idea was born to organize the fan dance. As it might sound somewhat egotistical, but in great part, it was a tribute to and a salute to myself and my own recovery.
And it's actually become quite a well-known event within the people that are aware of it. It's something I came across late last year. A friend mentioned it to me. I'd done the Para 10, which I found immensely challenging, but it was a good challenge. I was quite happy that I got a reasonable time out of it, and it's something that I'm looking forward to doing more. But you've also got some other test series as well, and various other challenges there that you've expanded on. So can you tell people a bit more about the test series that you've designed?
The test march series are actually my greatest passion. I do love the fan dance, and it is the catalyst from all else that follows. But I'm pretty much aware that I'm reduced to an ambassadorial role. I'm only sat base camp drinking brews, and I'm not actively involved in it. And some of the greatest marches I did on selection, which are endurance challenges that can rival anything on the world and as tough as any one-day event on the planet. Well, they are. They are the SAS and SBS test week marches. And on the fourth week of selection, there's six tests. And it can be likened to Herculean labours. They're extremely demanding. It's a significant step up from the fan dance. And we've basically given, outside of the official selection course, we've given life to these six marches, most of which have been in existence since selection began in the 50s. And they're a great passion. I'm actively involved in them, and I have an active mounting role. And I think for those our patrons who've taken part in them, so many of them claim it to be the greatest events they've ever done. And they're going from strength to strength.
With the test marches, are they weekend events, or are they multiple day events, or how do they work?
There's a form. There's prerequisites to be allowed to undertake the test week series. Firstly, you have to have completed the fan dance and put in a satisfactory performance. And following on from that, we have official training days. On a training day is, we've got extremely limited numbers, and we have a team of former SAS or SBS directing staff. We run all the patrons through radio communications, a wilderness, an expeditionary medicine, mountain survival, RV protocol, map reading and navigation, among other things. So, we ensure, just as a matter of, we have a duty of care to make sure everyone's safe on these marches because they're extremely demanding with a risk to life for those who are, you know, less than adequately prepared. Mm. You know, so we have to, and you have to bear in mind, before any soldier, even from elite units like the Royal Marines and the Paras, they undertake a briefing course prior to being allowed on selection, where they learn various standard operating procedures and techniques before they're ready for a course. It's a world-class training day. We've got field leaders in there, you know, in there, absolute experts in their field, and it's just as much a highlight as the test march themselves. And upon completing a training day, that then qualifies anyone to undertake any one of the six test marches.
And the six test marches, what distances are people looking at on that?
We don't give any distances or time or grids or routes. Everything remains in the stratosphere of unknown as per the real selection course.
Okay. So
everyone's unknown. They just turn up and they stop when they reach the FRV, and we'll tell them when they're done.
So it's very much a personal challenge that it works on. So it's as you said with your own experience with selection, it's your own personal challenge, and you've got to cope with the demands, and also you've just got to step up to it.
Well, there's the uncertainty factor again. They don't. They all they know is the start line grid reference, and then we'll give them a grid reference to the first RV. And they won't know anything further until they reach that next RV. And each RV they reach, they just get six more figures, which mean more pain. And they continue until we say stop. And you know, that adds a different dynamic to the event. Mm. I'm struggling to think of any other events where the distance on the route is completely unknown. People just turn up, and the finishing line is the most unlikely finishing line in the world of endurance sports or events. Indeed, there's no glamour, no handshakes, no blow up balloons or banners waving. It could be a track junction in a forest, a little hillock, a roadside in the middle of nowhere, nothing, no handshake, no nothing. And what we're trying to breed is a special kind of quiet confidence where you don't need congratulations and a pat on the back from someone else. You know, it's an event where people can go off into a quiet corner and contemplate what's just happened. And they are events apart, and we're trying to make them as close to the real SAS and SBS test marches as possible. And I'd like to think they are and will become the most prestigious endurance series in the entire UK. And I'm pretty confident they'll eventually be regarded as such.
Something that's come out in your book and also the emails and also on the website, you've mentioned a couple of times about the fan dance and also the test series that have the ability of giving you that fleeting glimpse or how it feels to be truly humbled, and also how you basically get to the absolute essence of being yourself. Is that something from personal experience, and is it something that was intentionally that you wanted to seek, or is it just because of the intensity of the experience and the demand that you put on yourself, it's something that kind of happens to you?
Well, nature has got this ability, if you allow yourself to be well and truly humbled. You become exposed and vulnerable. And, you know, it's then you begin to realize, especially in extreme weather conditions, why we can only thrive and survive with a big pack on our back, with all these safety provisions. I mean, we're so weak and feeble compared to a wild animal. We're only sustained in the way we are just because of the provisions we carry on our back. And without that, we're not much at all. And, you know, just factor in the uncertainty, the absolute physical demands of a test march, and you're getting closer to, you know, your former primitive self. And it's pretty, in some respects, can be a primeval experience. I mean, humans are flourished by their ability to move across the world and continents carrying their kit on their back. That's why we've dominated every corner of the earth, and, you know, we can be found everywhere. And, you know, it's selection's kind of a smaller version of that. You know, you've got a pack on your back with all your provisions, and you're just marching from one point to another. And if you know, you're totally immersed in nature, you're on your own, you don't know where the finish point is. And, you know, if that doesn't humble you, then you're You're closing yourself up, and you're not really permitting yourself to, gain the most from the experience. But I think by their very nature, these test marches do humble everyone who takes part in them. And no doubt, I think you do one of these test marches, and I know it's an idle claim, but just about every event's claiming now, but you won't ever be the same person again. You can't do one of these test marches and then go back to normality after that. And I've noticed a significant change in the character and personalities from when some of our patrons have started to now having done three test marches, Point to Point, Ricochet, and Ironman. Some of these people have now become different animals. It's interesting to observe. We've all got a greater level of confidence and ability, and they all seem to be embracing the wilderness and nature to a greater degree, and and they're all beyond that. They're realizing breaking boundaries of what they thought possible, and it's incredible to see some of the challenges beyond the test march series and the fan dance that people are lining up for themselves. The world's their oyster, and they're beginning to develop confidence in themselves, and they're putting themselves out there. It's pretty staggering. And indeed, a good number of the patrons are actually going for the TASAS just off the back of the events, and they've got a bloody good chance of making the grade too.
Oh, that's fantastic. Have you got any more surprises planned apart from the test series?
Well, our energies at the moment are focused primarily on the test march series. We've still got, by Easter, we want to culminate. We've got the Elan Valley marches, which, the Elan Valley really is one of the UK's last great wildernesses. So we're eager to pull that off, two marches back to back over a single weekend. And beyond that, the pinnacle of the test march series for long drag, or otherwise known as endurance, which will be staged in early spring of 2016. That is 64 kilometres. It's the only one we're willing to disclose the distance because it's ready available on the internet, but we'll keep a route a secret. And that should possibly be the greatest single endurance challenge in the UK. I mean, guys will be carrying £55 plus food and water, plus weapon, another £10. We're talking well over £70, over 64 kilometres over arduous mountain terrain. It's going to be something truly epic. Aside of that, we've got Exercise High Moon lined up, which is going to be a nighttime load bearing exercise, and there'll also be a fell running version. We'll be marking the route out with Sialumes. We'll be running it when there's a high moon state. We'll be trying to, especially for load bearers, we'll be replicating the SAS SBS selection night march. So I'm particularly looking forward to getting that off the ground. There's a few other surprises, but I'm going to try and keep a lid on them at the moment and reveal them once we're better positioned to follow up on the promises, as otherwise. We've got our work cut out for test march series. Each one demands so much in terms of risk assessment and route analysis. They're like full-scale military exercises, and they take a lot out of us.
Well, it sounds like you've got some exciting stuff planned and looking forward to it. I've got to start getting some preparations in. I was planning on doing the winter fan dance, but unfortunately it's kind of clashing with something else, and I've got to give preference to this now. So I'll have to start doing a lot more prep for it and take a look at the test series to do that. For people who've never done the fan dance, what advice can you give them, apart from one, they've got to go for it. Preparation wise, what advice can you give them?
Well, first and foremost, don't be intimidated by an SAS cap badge and the reputation of the event. It is achievable, and you can make a fan dance as utterly brutal or as easy as you want it to be. It depends how much you push yourself. It's one of those things you can take your time over it, but I would say that the harder you train and the more time you invest into it, the less you'll be hanging out on the day, and the greater the experience and the greater the enjoyment you'll achieve on the day. It's no use suffering all the way around and having a thoroughly miserable experience. So work hard, absorb all the training packs we send out to you, act upon the information, have good personal administration, and you know, you'll have a fantastic day. The fan dance has got an unrivaled level of camaraderie on the UK endurance scene. I'd argue there's no other event that can compare to it in that respect, and it's an authentic challenge. I don't think there's any other challenge in the UK that's steeped in such heritage or tradition, and certainly none run with such a strict military protocol. It's a bloody good day out, and I've got a lot to thank the fan dance for, and I'm sure anyone who's followed that hallowed route and trodden the steps of a history of young men in the search of something out of the ordinary would all claim it to be a life-changing event and among their very favourite events they've ever taken part in.
Yeah, definitely. I thoroughly enjoyed it when I did it in January, and I'm looking forward to doing another one, and I'm actually quite grateful I've been able to step up to the challenge, and definitely for people who are starting to consider this, pay very close attention to the instruction emails and the preparation emails, and it's not something to be taken lightly. You have to prepare very well for it, because it's going to be very demanding, and especially for the people who signed up to the Winter Fan Dance, if it's going to be as bad as what they say it is, it's going to be a very big challenge, and they're going to have to prepare well for it.
The fan dance certainly isn't a jolly. You can't just rock up and think you're coming for a bimbo or an easy day out, or you'll go out boozing the night before and you think you can tough it out like you maybe could for a Tough Mudder event, or I know something else like that. You're just, the fan dance won't let you get away with it. Nature's obstacles will catch you out, and before even on the mountain, the DS will catch you out as well. It's you've got to put some hard work into it, and respect the mountain and respect those that have been before you as well. Pay heed to the advice and instruction you're given, and it'll all pay dividends on the day.
Definitely. Ken, thanks a lot for taking time and speaking with me. I thoroughly enjoyed the chat, and looking forward to seeing you again sometime.
Okay, I'll hopefully see you on a test march sometime, Lance. Thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot.